Okay, I'm very happy to welcome Jan Pederson to Vanderbilt. Jan got his PhD at Stanford University in Statistics, following which he worked at Xerox PARC, Palo Alto Research Corporation. He then took the leap into the Silicon Valley scene and got a job at Verity Corporation. From there, he went to InfoSeek. InfoSeek was acquired by some other corporation, which was acquired by another corporation, which was purchased by somebody else, which was bought by Yahoo. And so now he works at Yahoo. And today he's going to tell us how search engines work.
Thank you, Bob.
So what Bob didn't tell you is that we were college roommates. We have a lot of...
Don't tell any stories.
I didn't.
So let me know if you can't hear me or feel free to interject during the talk if there's some particular thing you're interested in. So when Bob asked me to talk, he said, well, people are really interested in learning how search engines work. So I'm going to make an attempt to do that in an hour. Search engines are actually pretty complicated, so it's going to be somewhat compressed. But I'm going to try to give you a sense for some of the technologies that are there and kind of why it's interesting to work in the field and some idea of what the sort of big issues are. So I'll spend a little bit of time talking about context, what search is about. I think many people use search as consumers, but I just want to talk a little bit about the industry and how it's currently, some of the dynamics are. And then talk a little bit about some of the scaling issues, which might be interesting for people who are interested in a large-scale distributed computing task, because search is kind of a canonical example of a very large computational task, and it's interesting sometimes to see how those things are arranged and how it actually happens, because it's actually a big calculation that happens thousands of times a second and millions of times a day. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about search quality, which is a more of an AI-like topic. It's how do I make the search results actually relevant and good? What does it mean for a search result to be good? And what are the sort of issues that come up when people attempt to improve the quality of search engines? And finally, spend a little bit of time talking about some of the things that are just around the corner that are happening in the near future in the industry. All right, so let me start with the search landscape in 2007. So on the left there, you see a pie chart of search engine share in the US. And this actually comes from Comscore, which is a third-party metrics organization. And they actually meter people's browsers and they see what people actually do. And they report these numbers on a kind of monthly basis. And as you see, Google is the industry leader at this time. They have around 43.7% of queries go to Google. Around 28% go to Yahoo. And then there's MSN, there's about 12%. And then there's many smaller players like AOL and Ask and others. And so people think about this as there are really three major mainframes. And I use that term carefully because in the internet today, there's a kind of a return to an older computing style where there's a large machine, centralized in some sense, that has a lot of compute power, and the applications reside on that machine, and there are many clients that use it. And that's a very old computing model, and it has certain advantages and disadvantages. And right now, we see these mainframes, and these mainframes, by the way, that are powering these services are extraordinarily powerful. I mean, a supercomputer is probably a understatement for the amount of computing power that's actually harnessed to maintain these services or the amount of storage. It's really very remarkable. But there's sort of three major ones. There's Google, Yahoo, and coming on strong right now from a kind of operational perspective is Microsoft with Live Search. There are quite a few searches a day. So there are about 900 million searches a day worldwide, of which about 300 million are in the US. So about more than, about two-thirds of searches are actually outside of the US, international. And it's actually, in terms of growth, most of the growth is international. So US experience of web search is maturing. And people are more or less who want to be on the internet are already on the internet. People are who want to use search are already using search. There's sort of an increase in engagement and intensity, but you don't get a large number of new users except for population growth. While in other countries internationally, say, for example, in China, which is a booming economy, there are large percentages of the population that are coming online for the first time. And that's really where a lot of the growth is occurring right now in the internet. It's an expensive service. There are about $200 million a year is spent in capital expense to support the services. That means buying equipment, buying operation centers. So it's fairly capital intensive at this time, which makes it difficult for smaller players to play. it's not that difficult to build a search service, but it is difficult to scale it to this, the numbers that we're talking about. It's a big business. It's an increasingly big business. So it's about $15 billion a year this year in advertising revenue from sponsored search. So that compares to what it was like 2 years ago. 2 years ago was perhaps $3 or $4 billion. So it's ramping extremely rapidly. The growth rates are very high. So this is related to the sort of general trend of advertising dollars going from old media businesses like newspapers and TV to newer media where people actually are actually spending time on the internet. And there's an incredible growth and opportunity there, which is reflected in the capitalization of companies like Google, which is extremely large right now. The indices are enormous. So there are, typical search engine will have on the order of 30 billion documents in its index. So that's a very large repository, much larger than most people could have potentially contemplated even a few years ago. So it's in terms of the scale of things, of information that's available, it's quite remarkable. And the amount of storage is also huge. It's terabytes, actually petabytes, really. And so there's from a kind of infrastructure perspective, it's a remarkable feat. And then the final thing is that it actually works pretty well. It's excellent relevance. Most people are very satisfied with their search engine experiences. People have, well over 90% of people, if you ask them about their search engines, they'll say, most of the time I get exactly what I want, which is kind of remarkable. It doesn't speak to the things that they don't ask for because they don't expect to get. And so there's an opportunity there from a search engine perspective. But generally speaking, people are very happy with how these things perform. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about a typical search result page. I mean, I think most people are with, this is the Yahoo search page. And the first thing that you notice is the search box. And that's actually, characteristic of this service. So it's the only UI that people typically use, which is an empty box. Most of the time, if you approach a computer, that is to say, if you're a consumer, you're guided through menus or various other things that tell you what to do or what the series of potential things you might do is. Search is the only one where you have an empty box. You can type in anything you like, and maybe you'll get something interesting back. And that's a very unusual interface. In fact, there's an old joke about how it's the worst interface because you have no idea what's going to happen, really. And when people talk about sort of natural language interfaces, that's what they mean. You type in anything you want. And that's very interesting. It also is what makes it extremely hard from a technology perspective because you have basically the full complexity of what people might actually do given a blank slate to deal with and actually perform well relative to what's intended. You have specialized search services. So people think about the web searches, all the pages that are on the World Wide Web, but you also have vertical experiences, searching over images, searching over video content, etc. These tend to get less used. But over time, as people become more sophisticated, they have a tendency to sort of seek out more specialized services for particular kinds of tasks. So for example, image searching is very nice if you want to make a presentation like this and you're looking for a particular image, it actually works extremely well. And so there's kind of increasing engagement over time with these vertical services. Hit count. So that, you can barely read that. I can't barely read it. But it tells you something like, so the query here is physics, and it tells you that there are 80 million documents that hit. That's very interesting. Hopefully you don't have to look at all of those. And it came back in 0.15 seconds. So that's kind of give you some idea of the scope of the computation. It tells you some idea of how big the index is. Those numbers are there largely for PR for purposes. It's kind of like, how manly you are, how big your index is. Most consumers don't pay a lot of attention to that. But it's, in traditional sort of search technologies, people are trained to refine their candidate sets by looking at those numbers and getting them small by adding query terms, which is if you were a librarian, that's how you'd be taught to do that. Most consumers are never taught how to use a search engine, and so it's not actually all that useful as a piece of information. There's latency number, which I talked about, which is the time it took from when I made the request, it hit the server farm in the mainframe, the computation was completed, and the result came back. It's not counting the time it took to send that data back over the internet and render on your client box, because the service has no control over how bad your ISP is. But it's interesting how little time is actually spent. It's around 100 milliseconds, which is a very short amount of time to do a very heavy computation. There's another line here, which is query refinement. So the query is physics, and it says, well, maybe you're also interested in quantum physics, physics projects, poems about physics, I don't know. So these are queries that are related, that, you know, we've run some algorithm over the query logs, and other people, you know, people who type physics actually refine because they want a more specific meaning. They didn't want the generic one. And so, you know, they said physics, and then later on they said quantum physics, which is what they really meant. And so maybe that's what you really meant, so we'll suggest it. So it's a query log analysis. You need to look the statistical analysis of the query log to make interesting suggestions. There's a thing in the middle, which is what's referred to as a direct display. So there's news. So there's physics in the news. It's kind of like, did you know that there's another information source that you might be interested in, not web pages, but news. And it's things like... high school physics enrollment hits record high, some news item. So you might be interested in newsy things, which are not sort of meaty resource pages about physics, but sort of more sort of gossipy things. Finally, but most importantly, you have the search results there, and they're in the typical linear order. And what people have been trained to do is that they're in importance order. The first one is meant to be more relevant than the next, but it's a ranking problem. So because we're not really quite sure necessarily what you really want, rather than just give you one result, which would be what we think is the best result out of the 80 million that might match, we're going to give you as many as you like, but we're going to do it in importance order, so you can feel free to browse through that. And that's a very important, it's the only UI paradigm for search, and people have become, you know, used to that. But it's actually, if you reflect on it, kind of unusual. There aren't too many consumer services which are like that, which present you this menu of possibilities, you sort of scan down to see which one you actually want. And then on the right-hand side, there's another set of search results, which are the ads, the search ads. Now, the thing that's interesting about it is that those are advertisements. They're sponsored. There's a you know, commercial entity that's paying for those to be presented. They actually, it's a pay-per-click model, so they only pay if people actually engage with the ad. But it's information. It's ads. It's content. They're bona fide search results. They just happen to have a particular assumption of intent. They're assuming that you might be interested in some commercial aspect of physics, like textbooks and things of this sort. So if you're interested in that dimension, those search results are actually as relevant or potentially more relevant than the what's referred to as the free results or the algorithmic results, where there's no commercial entity sponsoring the results. So those are the main components. So let me talk a little bit about some of the scaling issues that one encounters if you want to build a system of this sort. So this is kind of a high-level picture of what the overall architecture looks like. And so on the extreme, oh, well, let me see, I can actually point at this. Here, you start off with the World Wide Web, which is big. Now, World Wide Web as a data source is very unique. Well, there are a couple of properties that are very interesting about it. One is that it's hyperlinked, right? So you have references to documents, you know, the things are cross-referenced. The second and very important feature is that it's extremely dynamic. So there are many, many publishers. It's not a central, it's a distributed publishing paradigm, so it's constantly changing. And because it's constantly changing, the whole notion of being able to index it is kind of a little bit curious, because by definition, as soon as you create an index for the web, it's out of date because something has changed. And so the very idea of a search engine is almost a contradiction in terms, many ways, relative to the World Wide Web, and that produces a lot of deep problems relative to the actual data construction. But you have here a crawler that is actually walking the web all the time, looking for content, and constructs an offline snapshot. So we actually have a copy of the web. Every search engine has a copy of the web. And you might say, my God, a copy of the web, it seems like kind of a waste, that already exists here, so why did you make a copy of it? And the answer is because the web is dynamic, you actually want to know what you want to index, and so you pretend it's static by making a copy of it, a cached copy. And so this is, you know, this is terabytes over here, by definition, because you're trying to get basically everything you can from the web. And then there's another question which comes up, well, how many pages exist in the World Wide Web? Right, and people used to write papers about that. They used to say, well, you know, the web is, you know, 100 million pages, and there was another paper, oh, no, it's not 100 million, it's 500 million, and oh, it's a billion, et cetera, et cetera. And, but the answer, of course, is that it's actually an infinite data source. Because, you know, the way that HTML works, you can actually back an HTML request with a program. So for example, and this happens all the time, I can, for example, have a calendar program, and I can make, it looks like I'm getting an HTML page, but I'm actually just getting a calendar, and the calendar program is very happy to respond in over the infinite timeline. So I can give you a calendar for any year, going back and forward. So in fact, there are as many pages as you like. There may be some notion of a finite amount of information in the web, but in terms of number of pages, it's not really interesting. So nobody writes papers anymore about the number of pages on the web, right? People maybe talk about the distinction between pages and the hidden web and things of the sort. And people like to count pages because it's kind of an interesting, it's an easy thing to understand. And if you've got more pages, you must have more information in your index. But it is, at the end of the day, actually rather misleading in many ways. Then you have another component, which is an analysis of the web, which is referred to as the web map. And this is basically looking at the cross-referencing. So, you have links that are cross-indexing pages, and you'd like to invert that. So I would like to know, for any given page, all the things that links. You want to sort of reverse the links on the web. That means that you need to stream over every page and maintain a database of the inverted links. And that's a very heavy computation. And then from that, you want to generate a lot of derived data. For example, authority numbers like page rank. You want to look at, do things like analyze pages for duplicates or near duplicates, find mirror sites, look at anchor text, all kinds of computations, which are very important for generating what's referred to as metadata, so data about the web pages that help you retrieve them. And then every once in a while, you suck the data from the snapshot and the metadata together to build an index. And this is, you actually you do the inversion. You construct what's called an inverted index, which is normally documents are a string of words in sequence so you can read them. In an inverted index, you invert that. You say, for this particular word, what documents do you occur in? And this is actually the basic data structure you need to make search go fast. And that's a very standard data structure from the field of information retrieval. And then finally, you push those out to this big farm of servers. And I'll talk about why they're sort of a big farm of servers to actually serve the queries. And the consumer is way over here, right? So the query comes in, it hits these things, and it's looking over this prepared index that has been prepared by this back-end content system. And it's replicated because of the load. So kind of the interesting points here, one is there's a big bottleneck here, because if you're trying to suck data from the web, you have to access every page. And so you can imagine if you have, you're constructing a 30 billion page index, and you want to revisit every page once a month, say, that has a big implication about how many bits you need to have here. And that's actually the bottleneck in general for that computation is the size of this particular pipe. Over here, the constraint is basically your paradigm for stream computing. So you have to do this big computation where you're streaming over the data and producing new derived data objects. And that's really where a lot of the utility computing happens, the sort of MapReduce, et cetera. Grid computing is applied here. Here, where you're actually constructing the index, is actually a CPU bound, because you have to do a lot of computation over every document to construct an index. And the cost of that really gates how frequently you do this. You'd like to do this very frequently, right? I mean, in principle, you'd like to build an index every day, so then you capture all the new information that you found. In practice, that's challenging from a systems perspective. And so the faster you can make this, or the more resource you can apply here, the more rapidly you can actually construct these indices. Then over here, you have a replication for reliability and load. So the load, the traffic load is very heavy here. This is where the tens and hundreds of millions of queries actually hit the service, and you have to be able to respond very quickly. All right, so this is actually a finer grained architecture slide that I actually stole from an internal engineering presentation at Alta Vista a couple of companies back. So it's safe for me to do that. But this is, in fact, how people describe what the operation actually looks like. So for example, here's a query, which is travel. And it hits, the first thing you do is you actually do global load balancing. You decide, you have data centers, multiple data centers for redundancy and reliability. So the first question you ask is, which data center are you going to go to? Are you going to go to the one in New York, or are you going to go to the one in Sunnyvale? And these are, this is the hosting, it was at level 3 hosting, right? So you had 2 hosting centers. Decision is made at this point, usually based on locality. Now on the East Coast, you want to go to the East Coast data center, and West Coast, West Coast. but you have an opportunity to load balance if you like. Then it hits his F5 big IP thing, okay, which is another load balancer, which sprays it across the web service, right? This is a web service. At the end of the day, we construct an HTML page, so it's a, you know, it's a web server, just like you would normally construct if you were maintaining a site. You have those things. But these are easily replicated. Web services are, you know, great in many ways because they're completely stateless, so you can have as many as you like. It's not really, in any sense, a computational bottleneck. And typically, there's a kind of a round-robin load balance here, so it's easy to handle very high traffic from the front-end perspective. And then finally, the query makes its way back to a mid-tier back-end service, and this is called, in this architecture, a query integrator. And the query integrator's work is basically to farm out that query across a cluster of machines that are implementing the search service and then integrate the results back up. So it's what's called a scatter-gather computation. So you scatter out to all these machines, each of which is doing a piece of the computation, and then you merge and gather the results back together. And this is a very classical architecture. This architecture dates back 15, 20 years, how you go about doing this. And then you have an individual search nodes, for example, WI11. This is a machine that has a slice of the index. It might have, say, you know, 2 to 5 to maybe 10 million documents indexed, typically allocated at random. So when indices are built, there's a hash code that actually distributes the documents at random across the available services. And it's going to take the query and evaluate it completely for its slice of the index and return what it thinks are the best documents relative to its ranking function. Report it back to this integrator, which will then integrate the results back up. And it will actually, based on global knowledge over all the nodes that represent the index, merge and get a single result set, which it reports back up to the front end, which constructs the page, which you actually see, and it goes back up to the user. So again, so this computation is 100 milliseconds. So it kind of comes down here, it hits the service, all the heavy computation happens here, and then this is all sort of, you know, traffic on the way back. So the interesting thing here is that, you know, the rows, each row of this array is a copy of the index. So it's a, you know, fully competent copy of the index. You have multiple rows because you carry a lot of traffic. So this integrator has a choice over which row to use, and if this row is busy, you can use the next row, et cetera, et cetera. So you can actually handle a lot more traffic in this design. The result sets are merged here. So because you're merging results, the latency, the cost of an operation, is the max cost of any one of these guys. Right. So if you're trying to gather all the results back up from a row, if any one of these guys is slow, then the entire operation is slow because this guy can't return until all of these guys return. So you have a kind of extreme value statistic that drives the overall response of the service, which is important because latency is what the consumer experiences. How quick is your service? So it actually drives the fan out. I mean, you can't make this thing arbitrarily large because that latency will become too big. You know, you can't have 1,000 machines wide. It wouldn't work, really. Yes. Yes.
It seems like the slide is truncated.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk a little bit about how people go about doing capacity planning. So let me just go through sort of a typical exercise. So, you know, you're a search service and you are experiencing a certain amount of traffic. And the usual rule of thumb, and you can kind of work this out, is that the QPS, which is the important number, QPS is queries per second. So remember that the latency is driven by the performance of a single box, right? So you can isolate. Talk about a box. It has a slice of the index on it, and it's able to process some number of queries per second at acceptable latency, right? And that's kind of a property of the hardware that you have available and your search algorithms, what you're doing in terms of the work. But that's kind of how you talk about the performance, the number of queries per second at acceptable latency in a statistical sense. That QPS is typically, you have to design for the peak, right? Because you obviously, as a kind of operator, you have to have acceptable latency throughout the day, including when you have maximum traffic. And that peak is, roughly speaking, twice the average QPS in order to hold it, in order to be able to serve the amount of traffic you're expecting to see. So that means that if you are experiencing 1 million queries a day, you require around 23 QPS per node in order to be able to handle that traffic at reasonable response time. Now, if you were handling the entire load for the US, so 300 million queries a day, you'd require 7,000 QPS. So if you think about the search services that are handling big chunks of the US traffic, you can see that the QPS, the design points for the QPS are in the thousands. So you're talking about thousands of queries per second that the clusters are designed to serve. And so then the question, the other important parameter is how big is your index? Because obviously, the bigger your index, the more machines you are, because you have to sort of separate it out, right? And there's another, you know, there's an important fact about the way the particular nodes perform. So here's a kind of a synthetic graph, but it sort of shows the shape of what the response curve is like. So you have QPS here on the vertical axis and index size over here on the horizontal axis. So typically over here, where you have relatively small index segment size, your QPS rates are relatively high. And the reason for that is that the indices are in RAM. So basically, you're just hitting RAM and you're doing a lot of computation. As the indices become bigger, you have to roll off and start accessing disk. And that's, you know, order of magnitude slower. And so you see these kinds of S-like curves. So depending upon where you are, you get different QPS. So it depends on your design point. So if you design for a 2 million page index segment, you get a fairly high QPS per box. If you're going to ask each node to carry more data, then you're going to get much slower. Lower throughput. So let's consider this, you know, fulfill this calculation. So let's suppose you want to have a billion page index. You want to have an index that's in total a billion pages. And that means that if you were doing, and these capacity numbers come from a public paper from an open source project called Nudge. So you can look it up on the web and they actually quote these performance numbers. These are not the performance numbers that you'd find at Yahoo or Google. They're Yahoo and Google because we have large development teams actually drive much higher performance than you'd be getting here. But it doesn't matter because it's the same argument holds. But if you wanted to, if you were doing this at this design point, you need about 500 nodes to achieve 50 QPS, right? Because 500 nodes at 2 million pages per node would give you a billion page index, right? So you'd have 500 QPS. And that means that you would be able to handle 2 million queries per day, right, with 500 machines. And 500 machines at around $2,000 a machine $100,000. So that's not that expensive, but if you think about it, if you were going to handle the full US load, you need 150 clusters, or about 75,000 machines, right? So when people start throwing around numbers, they say, you know, so-and-so company has 100,000 servers, you kind of wonder what the hell are they all doing? And the answer is, well, if you do these computations out, you start getting numbers on this order in order to serve traffic at this rate at big percentages of what's going on in the US. And then, of course, you have to double that for your international traffic. So your overall capacity has to be actually a factor of 3 larger than this, because you're handling traffic around the world. Now, you could be at a different design point over here and have, you know, a much slower node, but fewer of them. So at 2 QPS, you'd only need 40 nodes to implement a 1 billion index, but you'd only be able to sustain about 100,000 queries per day, so you wouldn't be able to maintain a very high traffic load, which means that if you wanted to do the full load, you'd actually need 120,000 machines. So it's interesting to note that this is actually not cost-effective. Right. It's not a good way to implement a high-load system. You're much better off with a smaller segment and a higher QPS because of the non-linearity of this response curve. And then another factor is, you know, caching reduces costs significantly. You can get a 50% cache rate, hit rate, and so you're actually only really paying half of this. Right. So, but these are basically the calculations, and this is why there's such a huge emphasis on operations in these businesses, because you're talking about tens of thousands of machines to implement a service. Plus, I haven't even talked about redundancy here. I mean, nobody runs a single copy of these things. You run multiple copies because one might fail, et cetera, et cetera. So the numbers are large. So one of the things that may have struck you in looking at this is, well, so if it's going to cost you to take so many machines to implement a billion pages, and I just told you that a fan out of 500 machines is actually impractical from a systems perspective, how do I implement 30 billion page index? Seems like a contradiction. And the answer is you become clever and you talk about tiered indices. So let me just take you through how you do that. So the key observation is that although you have 30 billion pages in your index, most of it is utter crap. And that's generally speaking the case, right? So, and that's true for any kind of published information. There's, you know, a very long tail of stuff that you really don't want to look at much. But the problem is that you don't know which of it is good and which is not good, right? And so you actually have to collect it all, right? But as a practical matter, when you actually observe the impression logs, so what people actually look at when they run queries and what's actually returned by the search engine, you know, 1 billion page index will in fact cover, you know, in excess of 95% of most people's search requests. Right? So it's the sort of the best of the web is really what people are actually looking at, and the rest is, you know, whatever it is and is rarely accessed and rarely looked at. But again, the problem is you don't know what it is, and therefore you can't. If you had a perfect oracle that told you what the right best pages were, then you wouldn't have to sort of stress about it. And so essentially what's going on in the search engine is this enormous resource being spent to capture that last 4% of what people are actually interested in. And there's a lot of expense associated with it. But that's kind of what the game is about in terms of comprehensiveness. And so the way you architect this is that you make a guess about what the best 1 billion documents are. And your guess is reasonably good, but not completely good. And you put it in what's referred to as a top tier. And you design this top tier for high performance. So you use the good performance points. You make the segments small, you make it very QPS intensive, and you invest a lot of hardware so you can take the full load. And then you run an algorithm to decide when you need to fail over. For some queries, you attempt to detect whether what the user is actually looking for doesn't exist here, right? And there's a very simple algorithm. The typical algorithm is, I don't have enough results to fill the page. And if I don't have enough results to fill the page, I'm going to fail over to this lower tier and access that and then return from that lower tier. And that actually happens relatively infrequently. So it might actually happen only 4% of the time I will actually fail over and hit this large index here. And you can design this large index to use the other design point, the one that has a really big index size but low performance because it's not being asked to handle a lot of traffic. And that's a very standard design. And some, you know, search engines will actually have three tiers. You might iterate this depending upon what your design points are like. So the nice thing here is that, you know, 900 machines can actually provide 50 QPS over 10 billion documents, while in the previous slide we had 500 machines give you 50 QPS over a billion documents. So you've gotten a tenfold increase in your index size by only paying twice as much in hardware, which is the trick, basically. So that's how these things get implemented. So when people think about it, they think when you run a query, I'm running that query over 30 billion documents, and the answer is sort of, but not really. Most of the time not, because it's not needed. Okay, so let me just talk a little bit about search quality. So when we talk about search quality, so this is the sort of AI-intensive problem of determining which documents are actually interesting and relevant to a particular user request. And we think about it really as having four dimensions. So there's ranking, which is the ability, given a result set, something that's been actually come out of this big farm of machines, a set of documents, candidate documents, arrange them in priority order so the best one is actually at the top. So that's the ranking problem. So it presumes that the selection has happened and now you need to rank. Comprehensiveness is really about constructing the index. It's about the crawling of the web. It's about how you take that crawl and construct metadata and how you actually construct your index. Freshness is this subproblem, which is about dealing with the contradiction between having an index and the fact that your target is constantly changing. So making sure that you're not too badly out of date. And the final one is presentation, which people have a tendency to overlook, but it's actually very important. What are you actually going to present to the user? What is in the title? What is in the abstract? There are a lot of many, many fine details associated with that that have enormous impact in terms of people's experience of a search engine and a lot of optimization around it. So let me just talk about comprehensiveness. So the problem is to make accessible all useful web pages. Now remember, it has to be couched in those terms because you can make an index as large as you like because you can constantly be getting junk pages from the web from infinite sources. So the trick here is to figure out what's actually useful, and that's a very elusive notion. And you've got finite resources to deal with. You've got finite bandwidth, although the bandwidth is actually very large. It's not difficult these days to get, you know, 1 gigabit lines. They're actually reasonably inexpensive. But the other constraint is disk capacity. You only have a certain amount of storage to actually keep your snapshots. So you have to make some, you have to have some policy that you're running to decide what content you're actually going to look for and what you're going to refresh. So we refer to this basically then as the selection problem. So this is a problem. Which pages are you going to visit over the many, many possibilities on the web? And that's really referred to as crawl policy. And then of those pages, which of those are you going to actually include in your index? They are a two-phase issue. So typical crawl policies, I mean, crawling is actually conceptually very simple. It's just sort of the implementation that it gets complicated. So you get a page from the web, you start someplace. Let's suppose you start at yahoo.com, which is what old search engines used to do. It was a very typical strategy. You just get that one page, find all the links on that page, and then recurse. Go, get all the pages that are linked to, and then analyze each of those and follow it on. And then you have, you know, well, are you going to go depth first or breadth first, and the usual kind of thing. But so there's this kind of the crawl policy could really be talked about as the prioritization of that process. So if you know, as you're crawling through this graph, how do you decide which of the many possible links that you could follow are you going to follow next? So this is a notion of the frontier. So there's a set of pages you visited in the past and the ones that you know about because you have URLs pointing to them, but you haven't been there. You have to decide which ones to go to. So you want to have a criterion. You want to prioritize visiting pages that are most likely to be returned by a search engine. So you have this kind of notion of quality. So there are many crawl policies typically quality-driven. So you have to have a query-independent quality number or quality concept, which allows you to say that this site is more interesting than that site, and therefore I'm going to spend more resources on it than something else. Then when I want to revisit, I want to prioritize revisiting sites which are likely to be changing more frequently than the ones which are not. And so those are the kind of the heuristics that are typically employed. And so here's a sort of a typical scenario. This is, you know, sort of actual data from a crawl at Yahoo, a research crawl, as they call it. So what this is some section of the web was crawled over a 30-day period, and what was recorded was time to first change. So you're sampling the same pages every day for 30 days, and you record when pages actually change. And what you see is very bimodal. So there's some pages, many pages, that change every day, right? So there's some pages which are actively being published, and they have a daily publication schedule or a weekly publication schedule. There's a lot of change. And there are also many pages that basically don't change at all. They're completely static. And then there's sort of stuff in between which, you know, change at a kind of random point in between, right? And so the trick in crawl policy and in the algorithmics is to distinguish these guys from these guys. Because these guys you want to visit every day and be very fresh, because they're going to drive your freshness statistics. And these guys, well, you can afford not to visit too frequently, and it saves you a lot of resources. And these ones in the middle is sort of, you know, a kind of a question mark as to whether what's going to happen to those guys. And that's kind of basically what's going on from an algorithmic perspective. It's a very challenging area. You don't actually have all the data that you'd like to have great algorithms. So generally speaking, you have a lot of heuristics, and actually assessing how well these things are working is a real challenge. So let me talk about a favorite problem of mine, ranking, which is basically most of the work I've been doing over the last few years has really been focused on the ranking problem, which is really, from a kind of consumer's perspective, the high value situation. It's a mix. I mean, if you don't have a good index and pages are not in the index, it doesn't matter how good your ranking algorithm is, because you're not going to be able to return. So comprehensiveness, in some sense, is the primary issue, which is why people in general, when they think about search engines, are very concerned about index size. Right? If my index is bigger than yours, there's an implication that I'm more relevant. Now, the question is, if I have 30 billion pages and the other guy has 35 billion pages, does that same logic actually hold? And that's something you can go think about a little bit. So there's definitely diminishing returns. So this is a problem of, you know, given a well-formed query, and I'll talk a little bit about why we say well-formed, because generally speaking, queries are not well-formed. They have spelling errors and various other things going on, which you need to sort of deal with. But let's just assume that the query is a correct expression of what the user wants. arrange the results that come back from the initial candidate selection so that the best ones are at the top, okay, the first few positions, because actually people's experience of a search engine is driven by the first few ranks 1 through 3. It's relatively rare that people descend below what's referred to as the fold. So the fold is what's visible without scrolling. They can't find things, but it's relatively rare. It's even rarer that people would go to the next page. So it's really about what's going on in those first couple of results. There's a big issue. There are many candidate matches. I mean, you saw in that last query, there was 80 million candidates that potentially just to select from, but you need to pick the three best that just present, right? And you need to do it in 100 milliseconds. Right? So that's the job. And then, the question is, how do you actually approach that from, what's the problem? And how do you know it's actually a good document? It seems like a soft criterion, and in fact, it is a soft criterion. So the relevance is actually a cognitive assessment. So you actually have to go to an editor and say, look, this is a query. These are the results I returned. Tell me if they're good or bad. And we have actually a fairly large staff of editors that do that day in and day out. They look at a lot of queries. They look at our algorithm and say, yeah, this is a good result. This is not a good result, et cetera, et cetera. And that's fed into what's referred to as a training set from machine learning perspective. So we get these labeled data, which allows us to.
So these editors are people.
Yes, of course. Yes, because at the end of the day, you're trying to match what people think is relevance, right? There's no objective criterion of relevance. It's what people think is good, right? So you have to get a judgment of good. And you can either do it editorially with staff that you hire, or alternatively, you can allow the masses who are actually using your service to do it based on their behavior. So you can monitor click behavior, right? So if you present a list of results and people don't click the first result, but kind of dig down and click some, that's telling you something about which of those results are actually good. But at the end of the day, you need that signal because there's no objective measure.
How many of these people do you have?
It's not. It's like I think it's 30 or something of this sort.
And each of them does a set of.
No, I'm not quite sure exactly how it's arranged. You have to avoid burning people out because you can imagine this might be a little tedious. So they randomize the activity. But the basic idea is that you have a query and then you have a randomized set of things. So you're not seeing things in the order in which the search engine produced them. They're randomized to avoid bias. And then there's a guideline that's presented. And judge those in terms of their goodness. So, excellent result, which is, perfect for this query based on my understanding what the user probably wanted. This is an okay result. This is a fair result. This is a bad result. This is really completely irrelevant. That's sort of a graded list. And these people can become good at making those assessments.
People are different. Maybe you should have queries for physicists, queries for other people.
Yeah, so that's true, and I'll touch on that a bit later. So, in fact, it is... It's more a probability of being relevant, where you think about the population of users. So that's really the right way you want to think about it, because it's not an absolute relevance. It's not an absolute number. And so, in principle, the editors are providing you a sample from this population, and we do in fact get multiple numbers for the same situation, which can be averaged. But that's correct. It's not the case that there's a absolute sense of relevance. It's a population number that you deal with in aggregate in general. Now you could talk about sort of specializing it for particular segments, and that's a more complicated thing. But in general, you're quite right.
So how do you incorporate this feedback into your?
All right, I'm going to get to that. So the particular approach we use, and this is something that we have in production right now, is we refer to it as machine learned ranking. And so the idea here, and this is, so if you think about ranking functions, traditionally what happens in, many IR situations is, people say, well, I have this number, and I have this number that comes from, matching, I have this, link authority number, I'm going to dream up some formula which is, maybe related to relevance, and I'm going to try it out and see if people like it. Kind of a very trial and error style of, heuristic programming of this scoring function. There are a couple of problems with that approach. I mean, it's actually a very popular approach. Programmers really like it because they can tinker around and they can sort of, believe that they're improving things. But the problem is it's very non-monotonic because You might change this thing and believe that you're improving this result, but it's actually, you know, pessimizing something over there, and you don't know because you're not seeing it. You don't have that global view of the overall effect of a change. The second problem is if you want to introduce a new number, and this happens all the time these days because all the easy stuff has been done years ago in terms of, you know, signals that drive relevance. And so right now people are mining much, much weaker signals of relevance. And integrating those things in is a delicate procedure. So you have to sort of figure out, you know, the first question is, you know, is this thing that I've mined out, this indicator, actually good at all? Maybe it's completely redundant. The information that's embedded in it has already been replicated in some other number, in which case, there's no way I can put it in and improve things. Or maybe it's because I'm incompetent and I can't figure it out, right? And those are two different problems. And you can't know. There's no stopping procedure that allows you to determine which of those is the case. So the idea here, and this is actually a very important point when it comes to these kinds of problems where you're combining many weak signals together to get a decision about or ranking, a priority ranking, is you have to have a evaluation methodology and a decision methodology or optimization methodology which is distinct from the procedure of constructing the features. Right, so that you can get a decision as to whether a feature is good or not, so that you don't end up in this kind of infinite loop. And so the way we do that is we do it through machine learned ranking, as I said. So you have a training set, large number of training examples. We talked about a little earlier how we construct that. And then we have features that predict relevance. So, and I'll go through what some of those features are. But they're things like, you know, matches of various kinds, matching in the title, matching in the body, matching in anchor text. So they're evidence that a document is good relative to the query. And then we have an assessment as to whether, in fact, the overall ranking is good. You know, again, we have this, there are various ways you can do that. We use a scoring scheme called DCG, or discounted cumulative gain, which basically you get a cumulative score as you go down the rank list that's discounted by position. So if I get the perfect result in rank one, that's the best I can do. If I get in rank two, I get discounted by a factor of two. I missed an opportunity. And the idea is taking this data in, and it's just data, automatically generate the optimal function for ranking that'll actually best match what's going on in a statistical sense in the training data. Right? So there's no human intervention in producing the ranking function. So you're completely factored out the sort of fiddling around issue as to whether I figured out the right formula or not. It's not an issue. The human has been taken out of the loop at that point. All the engineering work is in constructing the feature set and getting signal out of what's going on. And so that really enables rapid experimentation. So, you know, scientific investigation of, you know, modifications to features and new features, and that's actually very important because, again, at this point it's a game of a 100 little cuts, little things that you do to improve things. You need a way to monotonically improve things. So use formal definition, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. It's actually a statistical function approximation. Because remember that in this environment, we actually have a score. So it's not a binary thing. And something's not relevant or irrelevant. It's actually a degree of relevance. And you have things that you've measured. The X are the things that you've measured, the features. And there's some complex relation between these that's going to match what the editor is going to say. Right? And that's kind of your model that you have. And so your problem is to estimate that function, F, relative to a loss, and the loss is relative to the scoring of the overall result set. And this work is, you know, classical work in prediction, and we use a procedure from Stanford, actually, surprisingly, called boosted trees to actually do the fitting here. So I'm just going to give you an example of what this actually looks like, just to give you a flavor. But this, again, is an old example. It comes from AltaVista, no longer in production. But it gives you an idea of what we do at Yahoo, although at Yahoo we have a more extensive version of what's going on. So this was a training for a particular version of the AltaVista index over 140,000 judgments. So the training set is about 140,000 URL judgment pairs. That's been collected over time from editors. And then we have, I'll show you some code that actually gets generated. So here are some of the ranking features. So you get things like, these are the coded names for them. So you get things like anchor text scores. And these are actually, I think, roughly in order. So term weights, which is, some terms occur more frequently than others in the index. So for example, if I said something like Vanderbilt University, Vanderbilt is more important than university. because Vanderbilt occurs less frequently than university does. And many universities only one Vanderbilt, right? I think. So the notion of term weights is very important in terms of overall combination into the scoring function. The location of the match, there's some coding. The higher up in the document I matched, the better off. The more likely it was an important match. So in particular, in the title, it's the most important. And then early parts of the document are more important than later parts in general. A spam index. So we have a number that we produce, which is a machine-generated, again, sort of using a similar methodology, assessment of the quality of the content of the page, which is not based on graph analysis. It's based on, you know, is the English good on the page? Document length, EigenRank, which is a very similar to PageRank, etc. Some other sort of connectivity scores. URL depth, how deep in the web are you? Are you high up? Are you a root page? Are you deep or not? Is another indicator of relevance. So here, this is actual output from the fitting procedure. So it gives you this kind of indication of importance. So it actually tells you that, you know, this particular combination feature was the most important feature in the generated boosted tree model, for example, and it kind of goes down to these. And so we have modeling teams that look at these kinds of things, and they're trying to. And so this allows you to say something like, you know, the feature down here is not very important. You can probably check it out if you don't feel like computing it. I don't know.